Hello, it's Wednesday 24th of February. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On this week's show, Gary Bauman from Check In Asia and I will be debating tourism reopening strategies in Southeast Asia and beyond.
Yeah, there's hope in the air that vaccines may start to unblock the pathways to a travel recovery in the region. But are we simply going around and around in the same circles as 6 months ago? Let's find out over the next 30 minutes. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. This follows on from last week's podcast, where we looked back at 7 months since the Maldives successfully reopened to tourism.
Yep, all the talk is about reopening at the moment, Hannah. So before we begin, I've got a question for you. I mentioned at the beginning that, you know, we could be going around and around. A lot of the talk is similar to it was 6 months ago, but obviously the big differentiator this time is the vaccine. So vaccines are due to arrive in Thailand and Malaysia today. Indonesia and Singapore are already pushing ahead with their inoculation strategies, and those are the four countries we're going to talk about today. So how will vaccinations drive how governments strategize what happens next in travel and tourism in our region?
They're going to be inextricably linked. You know, a lot of governments have come out and said they will only reopen to tourism once certain islands or certain destinations have reached a, you know, 70% herd immunity. There's a lot of talk about prioritizing tourism workers for vaccinations first. Singapore Airlines, you know, they were flying their first flights last week with fully vaccinated aircrew. So really, I don't think we are going to see a proper reopening until the vaccination rollout has completed. And until that happens, and, you know, we've seen timelines from anywhere from maybe the end of this year for Singapore to 2023 for some other countries, we may not see significant levels of tourism until then. What's your take, Gary?
Yeah, I would agree with everything you said. I mean, it goes back to what we were saying 6 months ago, is that whatever happens from here, it is going to be phased. It is going to be gradual. Borders aren't just going to be thrown open anywhere, I don't think. The vaccine obviously is a key factor in enabling governments to feel more safe. And as you said, to vaccinate different sectors of their economy, including the tourism sector. But I've got a contention here that I'm going to put forward to you, Hannah. I've thought of three groups that may be in the box seat. These are globally in terms of reopening for tourism. So number one, I think, is going to be vaccine producing nations. So that is the US, the UK, China, India, Russia. Here in our region, Vietnam is developing its own vaccine. So is Thailand. Indonesia is producing vaccines on behalf of other vaccine providers. So that's number one, vaccine producing nations. Number two, I think island destinations for all the reasons that we've talked about before. Number three, I think, is countries with small populations because they will be able to vaccinate quicker. That's just a simple fact. And a fourth one that I'm going to add to this, just to add to the contention, is countries with governments that don't have an election coming up. I think around the world, we've seen governments say, oh, we were taken by surprise by COVID, but they can't say that with the vaccines. COVID-19 has become an election issue. We've seen that across our region. We've seen that in Australia with the state elections. So I think governments that don't have an election coming up will actually have an advantage here.
You know, I remember going off on rants last year about politics and reopening. For sure, I think that last category, yes. I'm not sure about vaccine-producing countries. You know, China doesn't look like it's going to reopen anytime soon. But maybe, you know, maybe I'll be surprised. But certainly smaller countries with very simple to manage borders, I think as well, you know, where there are only perhaps a couple of ways into them, which is where islands also, you know, play a part, because you can really control who is coming in and who is coming out. You haven't got those porous land borders like some other countries. And we've seen that even within Southeast Asia, it's these land borders that are often causing, you know, new waves of locally transmitted COVID cases.
Yeah, I think my point with vaccine producing nations, I mean, I think a couple of those, like the US and UK, that they will probably bounce back as outbound markets. But I think with some of the other countries, particularly China, India, and Russia, I'm looking more at the way that they can actually leverage their supply of vaccines to other countries, perhaps in future get exclusivity, or they can actually have a big say on how countries reopen. That could come as part of the political strategy later in the year, but it's not going to happen yet. I agree with you. I don't think China's going to open anytime soon, but I do think it's going to have a huge influence as a vaccine producing major.
Yeah, definitely. And it's actually not really perhaps related to tourism, but I read this morning that the Philippines are actually negotiating with the UK to get more vaccines by sending their Filipino health workers out there. So it's not just tourism as well. I think there's all sorts of other power plays in place for people with vaccines.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other interesting aspect, which we've discussed on the pod before, is Australia was talking about this recently, is overseas tourists. You know, you want to get overseas, particularly Chinese tourists, back into your economy because they study, they spend money in the economy. There's a lot of visiting friends and relatives as part of their stay. So you may be looking, countries like China might start sending out more of their vaccinated students back to countries where they can study again.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see that happening.
So let's begin in the region, Hannah, and Thailand. Thailand's top of everybody's mind at the moment because they've been talking quite big about reopening. What have we been seeing this past week, and how does that differ, or doesn't it differ, from sort of 5 or 6 months ago?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we have been talking about Thailand reopening forever at this point. So it started back, what, mid last year with the Phuket plan then, which was, I think, essentially kind of area type quarantine where people would be able to stay in the hotels and they wouldn't really be able to go out. And that kind of morphed into the special tourist visa, where Thailand is essentially open to tourists, but you have to have a hefty insurance and you have to undergo a 14-day quarantine. So it is not tourism as we have seen it. The latest version of this for Phuket a couple of weeks ago was Phuket were planning to undergo a private vaccination drive, essentially. So private businesses would obtain the vaccine, vaccinate the island up to, I think they were aiming for about 70% of the island to create herd immunity, allowing it to reopen fully to vaccinated foreign tourists by the 1st of October. Now, that was told, they were told last week by the government that private procurement would not be permitted. So that pretty much burst that bubble. But the interesting thing that has come out this week is that the Prime Minister now has said that they are considering whether vaccinated travellers will be able to skip quarantine so long as they have certificates, but they would need to track them. So we have had various other tourism stakeholders within Thailand talk about vaccination passports. The Tourism Authority of Thailand, TAT, have really been gunning for it. But this is the first time that the Prime Minister himself has actually raised it up. That, I think, bodes pretty well for reopening. You know, we've seen the tourism minister talk about it, TAT. Now, if the prime minister is talking about it, okay, I can't see it happening still overnight, but at least there is perhaps some more momentum that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. Obviously, we have to talk about the special tourist visa, which, you know, dates back to just before the winter, the Northern Hemisphere winter last year. We had those two high profile groups that came in from China. It was sort of a sample to see whether this thing would happen. I think in total during the year, you can correct me on the figure, but I think, yeah, it was about 10,000 were estimated that they would arrive during that period. We don't think it hit that figure. But it all obviously went quiet during the Northern Hemisphere winter because the big markets from Europe and also from Northeast Asia simply weren't going to be able to travel after what happened with the case surges that we saw over the period. And then this last couple of weeks, we've seen, what, Gulf tourists from South Korea. We've seen some European tourists come in and do a villa quarantine in Thailand. You start to feel that the momentum is building within Thailand to get this moving. But again, it's going to rely on the outbound markets to actually supply tourists to Thailand.
Yeah, absolutely. An interesting kind of nugget that I came across in an article in the Bangkok Post this morning as well was Qatar Airways, who've actually said that they will start operating flights back to Phuket if mandatory quarantine is loosened by March. And don't forget, Qatar Airways actually had this travel bubble with the Maldives, where Qatari citizens could fly in on designated planes. They could stay at designated resorts in the Maldives and enjoy their holiday. And I was looking at the stats. They're not huge. They generated about 3,000 tourists, but you could well imagine it could be a bit bigger to Phuket. So there are a lot of other tourism stakeholders at stake here, not just the government, who are going to be pressured to reopen.
Yeah. So let's just categorize what we mean by tourism reopening here, Hannah, because, you know, this is it's a big media buzz phrase at the moment. Where we are at in terms of the vaccine rollouts are still going to be relatively slow. They're going to go on for most of this year, probably into next year in most of the countries in our region, perhaps even beyond. So what we're looking at in terms of reopening, we've said it's going to be gradual, it's going to be phased. Now, most countries are promoting their reopening strategies, if they have one, as safe and secure. But I think a better phrase for that is controlled and restricted, because the tourism that we're going to be seeing when we reopen is not what we're used to before. So much of what we're going to see and the schemes that are starting to get talked about are basically charter flight based, they're pre-booked packages, there's visa application requirements, there's pre-flight testing and vaccine requirements, selected hotels and resorts only, whether you do a quarantine or not. There's in-stay testing, a lot of that. And in many cases, there's controlled itineraries. I mean, does that look at the moment the landscape probably for the rest of the year?
I mean, it could well be, I think at least until Q3. I think one of the main issues is still this question mark over whether, even if you're vaccinated, if you can still transmit the vaccine. I think if research suddenly comes out and proves that it will cut transmission, things might change. I think perhaps then countries will be a lot more relaxed about letting vaccinated travellers in and travelling around with an uncontrolled itinerary. But until then, they really want to make sure that they can track where they are going, that they, you know every move, every person almost that they have interacted with in case there is an outbreak.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I think a lot of that research is being done in countries like Israel, UK, Chile, countries that have moved ahead quite rapidly with at least their first jab of the vaccinations. There's a lot of testing. There's a lot of scientific research being done. I think there was a paper published or is about to be published about the Pfizer vaccine where the signs are pretty good in terms of transmission. But obviously, the more vaccines that come on stream, you know, we've probably got a handful at the moment, but in the next few months, there'll be at least 10 and then a lot more. There's going to be a lot more testing need to be done across all of these different vaccines, because it's going to be pretty hard to set a policy for a vaccine that your country doesn't even approve for its own population.
Yeah, that's right. That's going to be really interesting how countries handle that, right? And in some way, it's going to have to be standardized by the WHO. You'd need some kind of international body who is overseeing all of this and who is the authority. Yes, this... there may be a chance of transmission from this vaccine, or no, there isn't. And the whole process then of people being able to register to come in and having to prove that they have had the Pfizer or the Sinovac or whichever vaccine, it's going to be complicated.
So let's move on from Thailand to another of our favorite topics in recent months, and that's Bali, Hannah. So Indonesia has been pushing ahead with its vaccine program, but obviously it has such a huge population, around about 270 million people. It's a massive undertaking. But Bali, again, as we talk about an island destination, it has actually benefited from domestic tourism in recent months. How would it open up to international tourism? It tried it before. Can it do it again?
Well, this time they're calling it a COVID-free corridor. It's actually very similar to what Phuket was planning a couple of weeks ago, in that trying to inoculate enough people to have this herd immunity and then opening it up for vaccinated travellers. Now, who those vaccinated travellers are, you know, I think the vice governor of Bali has mentioned China. Other people are just talking about vaccinated countries or safe, you know, green countries. It's not really been fleshed out. But it does really seem to be Sandiaga Uno, the tourism minister in Indonesia, his priority. He is talking about it quite a bit. So I do just wonder if somehow it might come off. I think I was saying last week that I thought perhaps Indonesia would open up faster than Thailand with Thailand's moves this week. I don't know. I think the two of them are going to be competing, actually, for who's going to open up the fastest. But I think it will be this vaccinated travellers. I think you will have to be vaccinated. Otherwise, you're going to face quarantine.
There's an interesting dichotomy here that, you know, Thailand has put forward all these different proposals after the last few months, but generally people around the world don't care about those. If they are vaccinated, they want to go on vacation, Thailand is going to be a priority destination. I don't think there's much doubt about it. Generally, it's handled the outbreaks pretty well. It's a popular tourist destination. It's got all the infrastructure. It's got beautiful islands. It has everything that tourists are going to want. Bali, I think, is slightly different. It is isolated from the rest of Indonesia, but Indonesia hasn't handled the outbreak at all well for a number of reasons. The size of its population has made it very, very difficult. We're going to come on and talk about some of the rest of the reopening strategies briefly in a minute. But I just wanted to compare Bali with Sri Lanka. Now, Sri Lanka reopened to tourism a month ago, has this bio-bubble idea. But the interesting thing there in Sri Lanka is it's basically trying to keep international tourists and locals apart. I'm not sure that will be possible in Bali. That would be hugely controversial, particularly as it's such an important destination for Indonesian travellers.
Yeah, I mean, and you could say the same even for Phuket. I mean, yes, I think Phuket does rely more on international tourists, but they both face this issue of if you are opening up to international tourists, and letting them roam around freely, then what do you do about your domestic tourists? You know, do you cut them off and you say you're not allowed to visit Bali or Phuket without a vaccine either? You know, there's this big question mark about how that works. And like you said, we'll talk about how Sri Lanka handles that in a moment, but it's going to be very difficult to figure that out.
Yeah, so let's go back to September the 11th last year. Bali tried to reopen. It had this idea that it would, a three-phase reopening, which ultimately would bring back international tourists. It was a difficult time. There were many things that were against it, particularly the number of cases in Indonesia, and also that all outbound markets were basically closed at that point. There was no way they could actually attract visitors. I mean, do you think that if it were to reopen in the next month or two, even on a sort of slow phased basis, it would be able to attract charter flights that perhaps back in September it wasn't able to do?
I think so. I think we are seeing more nations now becoming vaccinated. So yesterday, the UK announced that they would be reopening its borders. And I've seen this morning lots and lots of travel agents showing a huge amount of interest from travellers booking their summer holidays. So I think if some of the European, maybe longer haul markets actually reopen, that might happen. What I am doubtful is that the traffic will come from Southeast Asia, at least initially. I think the markets that will come will be longer haul.
I agree. And I'm starting to wonder, I've been thinking about this for a while as well. If you bring back long haul markets, particularly from Europe, which, you know, will bring the numbers and brings the spending power, you know, is there going to be a bit of a feeling in Asia, we don't want to go where those people are going because they didn't handle the virus very, very well. We don't know whether it's going to be safe to be near them. Do you think some of these issues might pop up in the coming months?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that there is going to be this, you know, almost inherent racism. I think at the beginning of COVID-19 last year, we saw, didn't we, in Europe, people mistreating Chinese tourists or Southeast Asian tourists because they thought they looked Chinese because of this fear of having the virus. But I think absolutely now there's going to be, it's almost the opposite, isn't it? I think Asia has handled it so much better than other Western countries, than Europe or the USA. I think there would be a lot of hesitancy around visiting those same places or staying in the same hotel as some of these Western tourists.
Yeah, I would agree. And that is one, I've been saying this for a while, but I still have a feeling that if China is going to allow its visitors, its tourists to go out again, it will initially be looking at exclusivity agreements. I just think, I have a feeling on that.
So should we talk about Singapore now and what their moves they're making?
So again, this is coming back to what we were talking about several months ago, Hannah, is the Singapore-Hong Kong air travel bubble is back on the agenda. And so too is business travel, where you kind of stay in a bubble at the airport.
Yeah, it just feels like we're talking about the same thing over and over again, right? Sorry, listeners.
Were these actually quite good concepts in the first place, and they've actually been thought a little bit more over time, and now they're going to be improved and upgraded? Or are they just the only options available?
I think it's a bit of both, isn't it? I mean, for Singapore, yes, like we said, the Singapore-Hong Kong air travel bubble is up on the agenda again. So this was something that was agreed back in November. It was cancelled the day before it was due to launch because Hong Kong's number of unlinked locally transmitted cases had reached an unacceptable level. Now Hong Kong's cases seem to be dropping. The two are back in close discussions, the government has said, about reopening. The only thing is, you know, we're 3 months on since that last happened. Our opinions going to be completely different? Will vaccinations have also changed that? It's hard to know. But if it does come off again, we have still not seen that many leisure travel bubbles like this. It would be still a really interesting test case, especially for Southeast Asia, if it works and if there is demand there.
And going back to what we were talking about when it was cancelled, I did have a feeling that this would come back onto the agenda in the springtime. I think for a couple of reasons. One, Singapore and Hong Kong both don't have real domestic travel sectors. So if people are going to travel, they've got to get out of their country or their region. The two airports are the biggest and most important in our region as well. So there needs to get a bit of connectivity going there. And I also think that it was actually pretty well strategized last time. They'd put in place most of the protocols that were needed. It was just beaten by the virus. And both of these are quite determined and quite forward-thinking governments in terms of travel and tourism. So I did think that they would try to build this up again. It's a good point about what demand will be, though. I think that's an unknown factor, whether people will be more reticent or the other way. Maybe they actually want to travel more than they did before. And if it's the opportunity is Singapore, the opportunity is Hong Kong, maybe they would do that, particularly when it looks unlikely that there will be any other options on the table, maybe for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think that lack of other options would probably be the key driver. The other scheme which Singapore have finally launched, which they actually talked about back in December and was meant to launch in January, is Connected Singapore. So it's this idea of business travel in a bubble. It's not really a bubble, I would say. It's more almost as if you were staying airside at an airport, almost, isn't it, Gary? It's you are very separated. You're not really in Singapore. You are at a very dedicated facility. You have to stay within your own bubble. You don't even get room service. They just leave your meals outside. And if you do need a meeting with your counterparts, which was presumably why you're going there, you know, the meeting room has this big plexiglass through it. They even sanitize the documents in a little hatch for you to sign before you pass to the other people. I suppose it's a way of opening up for really essential business transactions that have to be done face-to-face. But in terms of generating income for the tourism economy or generating demand for the local tourism economy, this is not going to be it.
100% agree. I think this is done specifically to speed up deal making, deal signing, get investment deals done. I think that's the only reason. There's possibly a second reason as well, and that's the World Economic Forum coming up later in the year in August. Maybe Singapore just wants to show that it is actually actively trying to promote business travel. If it wasn't doing that, then it would be almost pointless hosting the event in a closed country. And Singapore has been trying different ways to open up these green lanes and these, you know, these different business track options. It hit a brick wall pretty much before the winter. But yeah, I think this is just part of a phased reopening. It's not going to impact the tourism sector at all. But you know, a lot of these reopenings aren't really going to do that. They're only going to scratch the surface anyway. This is basically scene setting for something that we hope will be on a bigger scale, maybe later in this year, but perhaps more likely in 2022.
Very true. So let's have a look at what other models some other countries not in Southeast Asia are using, shall we, Gary, and see if any of those could be used in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed last week, we only really need to mention this briefly. Maldives is being sort of held up as this case study. It's 7 months reopening now. It's been relatively successful. It's been pretty well managed. But, you know, as we discussed on the show last week, it has a specific geography, has a specific tourism product mostly. You know, Ruth Franklin talked about some of the other inter-island options, talked very well about those. But, you know, the resort tourism has really been the bounce back. It is a good case study for island destinations, I think, because they've managed it so well. What do you think about that, Hannah?
Yeah, I would agree. You know, like you say, Maldives has a very unique geography. It's pretty lenient entrance requirements, really. You know, filling in an online health declaration form, you need this negative RT-PCR test 96 hours prior to arrival, download a contact tracing app, and that's it. So in terms of the actual getting in, it's a very, very kind of streamlined process, really, which is good. But would it work in Southeast Asia? I'm not sure. I think Maldives would have a lot less cases of... I think the Maldives would have a lot fewer domestic tourists than other countries within Southeast Asia. And I think it's where the domestic tourists come in that's the trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I agree. And it's a very desirable destination for specific types of holidays as well. And which I think leads us on to our next country, which I would say over the last year has become an even more desirable destination, and that's New Zealand. Has managed this outbreak so well that, you know, they, in the words of the Prime Minister, that they went early, they went hard, and they continue to be extremely meticulous on eliminating the virus as much as they can. It has opened up one-way travel bubbles with Australia, the Cook Islands. The Australia bubble has sort of opened and closed again, depending on outbreaks in Australia, but I think it's back open again now. New Zealand has said it won't really be doing many more. It might look at a couple of bubbles with other Pacific Island nations. Australia said the same, that it may be looking to Pacific Island nations, perhaps Vietnam as well. So there may be some movements in those two big destinations and big outbound markets too, but it's going to be very, very gradual and phased for this year, for sure.
Mm. So how could that be, or could anything be applied from that to Southeast Asia? What do you think?
Vietnam would be on radar for both countries if they were able to do a bilateral bubble or even a one-way bubble. But in terms of what can be applied, well, I think the learnings go back to the way they actually managed the virus. And that now is sort of, that's been done, isn't it? We're now looking at the vaccine stage rather than the suppression and containment stages. I'm not really sure there's a huge amount to learn. I think the only thing is that they will be hugely popular destinations for Southeast Asia tourists if we are able to get on a flight to either country. I mean, I would go back to Australia tomorrow if I was able to do so, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the key items from here is that they are two countries that are very, very key inbound and outbound markets for one another. And they are also roughly at the same level of COVID cases too, although, like you say, New Zealand was, I think, a little bit more advanced, more eradicate than Australia. Perhaps that's the learning. But are there any countries in Southeast Asia that would fit those bubbles? Not really, I would say, actually. I think a lot of the countries are at complete, nearly every country in Southeast Asia is at a completely different level. And just when you think that they kind of level off, so you'd say, okay, maybe Vietnam could be comparable to Singapore in terms of COVID cases, then Vietnam goes and gets another wave of COVID. So it's tricky.
Yeah, I mean, you look at those two destinations, and in terms of as an inbound destination, there's obviously a cost factor. So if you look at the countries that have managed it best in our region, you'd say probably Laos. Is there enough outbound demand to go to New Zealand or Australia? Probably not. Brunei, there is spending power there, but it's a very, very small market. Maybe a test market, though.
Yeah. So should we have a look at Sri Lanka then? So we mentioned Sri Lanka a little bit earlier in that they are keeping their domestic travellers and their international travellers separate. So let me fill in the blanks for people who don't know so much about what's going on there. So they reopened the country from the 21st of January, and they still have an isolation period of 13 to 14 days. But it's different to say how the special tourist visa works in Thailand. Because you can go around in these bio bubbles. So you have to stay in what they call a level one hotel. So a level one hotel can't accept local tourists. They can't even hold events for locals either. You can't use public transportation in the first 14 days. And you can go to specific tourist attractions, but these are very kind of limited. There are some of the big ticket attractions there, but I'm not sure it would be enough to keep you occupied if you were really there for the full 14 days. It's the same. You have to have a test on arrival. You have to bring a test with you. And depending how long you're staying, you have various tests on different days as well, just to check whether you have COVID or not. But one of the interesting things for me from the travel trade side, actually, are kind of the sacrifices you have to make if you choose to accept these tourists. So the hotel staff who are in these level one hotels, they can't go out freely. If they want to leave the hotel, they have to do a 14-day quarantine before they can go out from there. The tour guides also have to do quarantines. It's a really big commitment, I think, for these hotels or these travel trade to say, yes, I think it's actually worth it to go for the international market.
You know, it's really a return to sort of 1970s, 1980s travel for the elite, pretty much, isn't it? I saw there was another requirement as well, that hotels have to charge a premium for minimum insurance cover, which I can't remember. There's a set flat fee, I think, for everybody that stays there. They have to pay a premium. So, you know, there's the opportunity for that to get marked up. There's a visa process situation as well. Yeah, I mean, we've really regressed in terms of the way we're looking at tourism if this is the future, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so could this be applied to Southeast Asia? I mean, yes, Sri Lanka does have the domestic tourists, so this is how they are handling that issue. But it would still be probably a quite bitter pill to swallow for the travel trade to do this in terms of not being able to leave the hotels and really keeping people very separate.
Yeah, you could only really manage this on some of the islands. Like Sri Lanka is an island, of course. I don't see there's any way that you could manage this on mainland countries in Southeast Asia. I think the social pushback would be too much.
And you spotted an interesting model with Costa Rica, right, Gary?
Yeah. So Costa Rica has very close relationships with China and has done for some time. And it's this week the Minister for Tourism announced that they will implement visa-free access. Remember that? Visa-free access. That used to be part of our industry. They're going to offer visa-free access from March for Chinese visitors from two cities, Beijing and Shanghai, the two primary cities in the country. Again, this is a very controlled and restricted. Tourists would have to buy a specific package. They would have to register with an approved Costa Rican tour operator company, which again takes us back to the early 2000s, I guess, and approved destination status from China, where you can only go through approved tour operators. Costa Rica, obviously a beautiful country, allows travelers to get back into nature. It's a long flight, though. But again, you know, would this be offered on an exclusive basis to Chinese travelers? If so, there's a possibility that charter packages may be able to start up later this year. I don't know. I think a lot of countries are going to start offering this to Chinese travelers because it's the comeback market that absolutely everybody wants. China's going to be able to pick and choose which ones that it's going to allow its travelers to go to or not. Yeah, I guess it's pushing the envelope. It's just getting your cards on the table to say that we will allow this.
Yeah, the one thing I thought that was a little bit of a fly in the ointment for this is that the only connectivity from China is via Europe. And I just can't see many Chinese tourists wanting to connect via Europe right now with the cases there.
Now, it is now, but I would suspect that the negotiations to if they open exclusivity, that they'll get direct charters, maybe go through Singapore. I don't know. They will go through somewhere and there will be charter flights rather than connected scheduled flights.
That's true. I mean, and I can see this kind of model applying for countries like perhaps Laos, perhaps Cambodia. This visa-free, but having to register through a tour operator so you can at least keep track of the tourist's itinerary.
Yeah. And so next up is one of my discussion points from the beginning is vaccine-producing nations, which is Cuba. Now, vaccine tourism is starting to be promoted from Cuba, which is actually developing its own COVID-19 vaccine called Sovereign O2. Once it completes its clinical trials, I think it's actually going through that process. It's near to completion. The early stages are suggesting that it actually has a long-term immune response. It's a three-shot vaccine. So the opportunity is for travelers to go take one or two shots of the vaccine and the other one to go back with you, because apparently there aren't any refrigeration requirements. This is really pushing the envelope for vaccine tourism, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that could be super interesting, isn't it? One, take one back with you to go. I love that concept. But yeah, it would be interesting to see if any Southeast Asian country does decide to go, you know, down that route, down that vaccine tourism route. But right now, I think they are all just scrambling to secure their own supply of vaccines. So I can't see vaccine tourism happening anytime soon.
No, I would also agree with that. I think Cuba is basically promoting this as a way to bring people in, probably from the big markets, maybe China. You know, it could be an alluring destination for well-heeled Southeast Asian travelers. But yeah, I don't see this model being applicable to Southeast Asia. One final country to mention, Hannah, and that's India. Obviously, another big comeback market that everybody in the region wants to attract travelers from. Also a popular destination for travelers from Southeast Asia. And it has this idea of a calibrated reopening. These buzzwords are just flying, aren't they? A calibrated reopening for tourist visa holders.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't really given any more details other than that. They said they are discussing the possibility of no quarantine for vaccinated travelers. But certainly this would be a really, really interesting one, wouldn't it, to reopen it? It's a massive market, presumably, hopefully, if they would reopen to tourists coming in, perhaps they would also allow tourists out. And obviously, India is a massive source market for Southeast Asia. So it's one to watch. I think that there is a perception that India does have quite high cases. So that might be something that they're going to have to fight against to reopen and convince people that it is safe. But yeah, calibrated. I think they're copying Singapore. I think Singapore said that one first last year.
Yeah, it did. Another vaccine producer. It's been supplying tourists to the Maldives over recent months. There were media reports this week that there have been inquiries for huge luxury Indian weddings in Thailand. It's an important market for Malaysia as well. Other countries in the region as well. Bali, it's a popular destination. Vietnam too. So you know, India is going to be an interesting player as countries start to reopen. But you know, you may be right. It may be a little bit too soon, just given the fact that although numbers have come down quite rapidly there, they're still relatively high.
So that brings us to the end of this week's ASEAN reopening edition of the show. We hope you enjoyed the show, and don't forget to send us your thoughts or comments on what we discussed or what we missed out, especially if there are any other reopening strategies you think might work in Southeast Asia. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, and as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Cast, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for this week. We're both off to go register for our vaccines, and we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, see you next week.